Chapter 9. By Dole and the Reagan Acceleration. The 1974 midterm elections are remembered for the wave of fresh blood they brought into the Democratic-controlled House. The class of first-term Democrats, 75 in all, the youngest only 25 years old, were named Watergate Babies after the impeachment scandal that concluded the previous summer. Many were marked by a skepticism toward the national security state and had campaigned on promises to curtail its power and abuses at home and abroad. Less discussed were their differences with democratic economic traditions, especially on policies touching on regulation, antitrust, and corporate power. In an early sign of this generational break, Watergate Babies led efforts to strip Wright Patman of his chairmanship of the House Subcommittee on Banking and Currency. Together with Russell Long in the Senate, Patman was a vital living connection to the New Deal anti-monopoly legacy and vision for public science. Signs of impatience with liberal loyalties also marked the congressional class of 1976 and Jimmy Carter's White House. A leaked strategy memo prepared in early 1977 by one of Carter's closest advisors, Pat Cadell, discussed how the administration could adopt many of the Republican positions and ignore the inevitable rumblings from the left of the Democratic Party, who are as antiquated and anachronistic a group as are the conservative Republicans. Some figures from the New Deal who remained on the scene reappeared in a new guise. Alfred Kahn, the wunderkind theorist of New Deal patent skepticism, became the leading force in the deregulation of the airline industry. No longer interested in how patents retarded innovation and plugged up competition, he penned an influential book, The Economics of Regulation, credited with laying the basis for the undoing of his party's regulatory legacy, beginning with the Aeronautics Board established by Truman. These shifting political winds were welcomed within the industry Republican effort, now in its second decade, to replace the Kennedy patent policy with one granting contractors monopoly access to federally sponsored inventions. Since the successful NIH boycott of the mid-1960s, the effort had ground to a frustrating stalemate. A wall of opposition in Congress stopped cold every legislative attempt to reverse the policy. The federal agency chiefs appointed by Nixon and Ford, meanwhile, were of little help to the cause. It was Nixon's Justice Department, after all, who had codified the 9 no-nos of anti-competitive practices. In the end, it wasn't a political shift that gave enemies of the Kennedy policy the break they needed. It was an economic one. The prospects of the crusade to open federal science to private claims brightened when those of the national economy began to darken. In 1971, the United States posted its first trade deficit since 1893. The March 1973 issue of Newsweek introduced Americans to a British term, stagflation, to describe the double bind of high inflation and unemployment. In 1975, the U.S. economy posted its first trade surplus in 4 years, but in the context of a full-blown recession. None of this was good news for any sector of the U.S. economy. But the research industry seeking movement on the patent issue sensed opportunity. As the economy contracted during the Ford and Carter years, the anti-Kennedy policy alliance, grown to include venture capital and the nascent biotech industry, struck up a fresh rationale for bequeathing patents to government contractors. It centered on a new word in the country's political and economic lexicons, competitiveness. According to the latest script, government patent ownership not only inhibited commercialization, it undermined America's ability to compete with the recovered economies of Europe and Asia. Unless U.S. firms had exclusive access to the latest science to do with as they pleased on a monopoly basis, they would be crushed on the global stage by technological rivals. The sclerotic New Frontier policy of default government ownership must give way to a dynamic industry-first policy that incentivized innovation by handing inventions over to the private sector. Monopoly was not a threat to American strength, innovation, and global leadership. It was their precondition. At a time of sliding trade balances and stagnant wages, stamping the Kennedy policy's weak and self-defeating was clever. It was also specious. The competitive argument was premised on the false assumption that public science was hidden away under lock and key. In reality, government science, especially the medical research coveted by the drug companies, was by definition available for licensing and use. Companies did not lack access to government science. They just wanted the right to deny that access to their competitors. The argument broke down further when comparing the U.S. policy with those of the countries challenging America's technological preeminence. All of them had far weaker intellectual property regimes than the United States, especially when it came to medicines and public health. The most formidable new rival to U.S. technological leadership, Japan, maintained a much weaker patent system, among other things requiring the licensing of most patents, says F.M. Scherer, the FTC's chief economist between 1974 and 1976. During Republican-led hearings on how the Kennedy policy was hurting the economy, Carter's Federal Trade Commission chair, Michael Perchuk, explained there was no factual basis for Republican claims that government patent control slowed down the commercialization of government science. The available evidence shows just the opposite, he told the red-faced senators. There is no need to study the patent policies of Japan or Germany because the best case against turning public science into private monopolies was the high-tech innovation surge on the cusp of transforming the U.S. economy. The foundational technologies of the information economy, solid-state transistor circuits, lasers, fiber optics, had origins in three things: publicly funded research, liberal government, licensing of that research, and above all, a 1954 Justice Department consent decree that forced open Bell Labs' patent vault and diffused its contents. Had corporate America's most notorious high-tech monopolist and knowledge squatter been allowed to continue hiding its patented technology on bunkered shelves, the course of U.S. competitiveness in the 20th century would have looked very different. An understanding of this history, together with the influence of psychedelics and the counterculture, contributed to the open science ethos of the young Silicon Valley. The disco-era push to privatize public science also featured a Cold War trope most closely associated with the president whose patent legacy was under dispute. Just as Kennedy accused Richard Nixon before the 1960 election of allowing a missile gap to open up with the Soviets, the patent reform strategists blamed the Kennedy policy for allowing an inventions gap to undermine public health and threaten American competitiveness. This inventions gap concerned an alleged mountain of government patents being blocked from productive development and use, each one a piece of progress lost to dogmatic statism. The inventions gap meme was conceived in the summer of 1976 by Howard Foreman, a former chemical industry patent lawyer serving as a deputy assistant secretary of commerce. Speaking before the House Committee on Science and Technology, Foreman claimed the government was allowing 28,000 patents to languish. In his written testimony, the number was 26,000. Each of these patents represented, in his telling, an invention kept from American industry and the public by a selfish and inept policy. Whatever system we've been using is not helping to contribute to the promotion of the progress of the arts and sciences, because I understand that only about 5% of those 28,000 patents have been the subject of some kind of licensing action, Foreman told the committee. The greater majority of those patents are not getting into use, and they are doing no good to anyone. Foreman's argument that by refusing to offer contractors monopoly rights to these inventions, the government was actively suppressing their diffusion and development, unsettled lawmakers in both parties. But it landed with a force proportional to their ignorance about how patents work. Where Kennedy's missile gap involved a quantifiable difference in the number of U.S. and Soviet rockets, Foreman's gap involved subtler distortions of the truth, each constructed to exploit the innocence and insecurities of lawmakers and the public. The first distortion was the insinuation that most patented inventions are ever licensed for production, when the great majority of inventions, patented or not, interest no one. The U.S. Patent Office issues thousands of patents per day. Only a tiny fraction ever result in applied technologies or new products. Making Foreman's number even more meaningless was the fact that government-owned inventions are routinely used without anyone bothering to obtain a license, because the entire purpose of government ownership is to guarantee access and encourage the use of knowledge, not release hound-dog patent lawyers to track the scent of infringement. This was explained in the counter-testimony of a 79-year-old Navy admiral named Hyman Rickover, then and still the longest-serving officer in the history of the U.S. Armed Services. The legendary founding director of the U.S. nuclear submarine program, Rickover was famously strict about keeping patent rights in government hands. He was also angered and baffled that anyone in Congress could think doing otherwise was a good idea. In testimony before a Senate subcommittee on the Constitution in June 1979, Rickover urged lawmakers not to fall for the age-old arguments of the patent lobby. He dismissed Foreman's statistics about government invention as sophistry because government agencies do not have a reason to search for patent infringement. The government, unlike private parties, generally has no desire to prevent others from using its inventions. The reasons the government should take title to these inventions are primarily to ensure the government is not subsequently barred by someone else's patent from using the idea, to preclude the establishment of a private monopoly for a publicly financed invention, and to ensure the public has equal access to these inventions. Regarding their claim that non-exclusive rights were blocks to progress, Rickover told the senators, "Truly good ideas tend to be used." Forman's case was on thinnest ice regarding those industries with the most to gain, pharmaceuticals and biotech. In a review of HEW licensing practices between 1968 and 1978, the very decade Forman described as an inventions gap dead zone, law professor Rebecca Eisenberg found that the health agency licensed a full quarter of its roughly 350 patented inventions. This is more than double the licensing rate of universities who were granted patents under the IPA program during the same period. Between 1968 and 1981, companies who gained patents under HEW's IPA program licensed just 9, resulting in a grand total of 4 commercial products. Still, the alliance pushed on with its arguments. Though the campaign was supported by the usual suspects, the National Patent Council, the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, it wasn't organized out of the private suites of industry and its lobbyists. Its messaging and political strategy was developed by a rogue brain trust of bureaucrats inside the Departments of Commerce, Energy, and in the case of its most senior and influential member, Health, Education, and Welfare, the very fortress they were preparing to storm. Following Jimmy Carter's election in 1976, Forman, already at work on the inventions gap, organized a few like-minded officials into an informal group called the Government Patent Policy Committee. Like him, they were mostly holdovers from the Nixon and Ford administrations, who worried that HEW's grip on government research would tighten further under Carter's new man at HEW, Joseph Califano, a liberal Democrat who had helped Lyndon Johnson steer the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. Califano lived up to his reputation and confirmed their suspicions. During his first 2 years in office, HEW did not grant one patent waiver under the IPA program. One member of the group was a fellow ex-patent lawyer named Norman J. Latker. Latker had served as general counsel to HEW since the early 1960s, forced to oversee a patent policy to which he was ideologically opposed. Over the next 15 years, he privately developed working relationships with those at the center of efforts to undermine and overturn that policy. While on the public clock, Latker was legally obligated to enforce the policy set down by his boss. It was a double life. The first patent bill advanced by the Forman-Latker circle was a swing for the fences. Introduced to the House in April 1977 by Arkansas Democrat Ray Thornton, not even the legislation's most passionate supporters, Barry Goldwater Jr. among them, denied it was a pure distillation of industry desire and its hatred of liberal science policy. In the words of Betsy Anker Johnson, a Boeing physicist who was active with the Forman-Latker group, Thornton's was a patent policy as perfect as we could make it, one totally devoid of the shortcomings associated with political expediency. It was also devoid of a snowball's chance in hell of becoming law, or even being reported out of committee in the Democratic-controlled House. In the Senate, Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson convened his subcommittee on antitrust and monopoly for the sole purpose of warning his colleagues not to consider introducing a Senate version of Thornton's bill. "If this group of Commerce Department employees has its way," said Nelson, "the government would end up giving away to a small number of companies the rights to every invention produced through government finance research." When asked about the bill, Russell Long snarled, "It's a beaut. What a real giveaway should be like. It doesn't leave even a sliver of meat on the bone. This proposed legislation is one of the most radical, far-reaching, and blatant giveaways that I have seen in the many years that I have been a member of the United States Senate." The humiliating defeat sent the patent lobby back to the drawing board. Despite decades of ideological song by Robert Bork and other Chicago figures, the anti-monopoly and patent legacies of the New Deal were proving stubborn and difficult to fell. It seemed unlikely a reform bill would get past a phalanx of old guard senators and Jimmy Carter. But the oil shocks and deepening anxiety about the economy continued to put long-shot policies in play in unpredictable ways. The reformers doubled down on the line that an attachment to liberal dogma was holding back progress in creating a strategic inventions gap. They hoped the refrains repeated in op-eds, think tank reports, and Senate hearings would drown out the rebuttals and counter-evidence presented by FTC, Justice, HEW, and Defense Department officials. Moving public opinion would not be easy. Drug companies and drug monopolies remained burdened by enormous baggage stored in the nation's collective memory. The pricing and safety scandals unearthed by the Nelson hearings were fresh in the public mind. Most Americans remembered the Kefauver hearings. Anyone over the age of 60 was around for the TNEC, Arnold and Kilgore investigations. This presented a challenge. How to pass a bill that expanded the scope for drug monopolies without triggering public suspicions about drug monopolies. The patent lobby settled on a solution of elegant simplicity. Keep the drug companies out of the picture. If politicians and the public associated abusive pricing and anti-competitive behavior with the Mercks and the Pfizers, don't mention the Mercks and the Pfizers. Within weeks of the Thornton disaster, the Latker-Foreman group began to work on a new bill, defined by one major revision. It restricted patent claims on public science to small businesses and universities. The bill was crafted to draw attention away from the drug companies and exploit public ignorance about the rise of university patenting since the 1930s. Few understood that research universities were now in the business of maximizing revenue by licensing patents on exclusive terms to drug and biotech firms large and small. The new bill merely added an extra step on the way to monopoly, one that effectively pushed the companies into the shadows of the debate. This extra step was always conceived as temporary. Once an initial tear in the policy fabric was made, the law could be easily expanded to include the multinational drug majors. But they still needed to pass the law. This daunting task would be easier with an effective champion in Congress, ideally one of a higher weight class than the lowly Representative Thornton. It turned out to be a brief search. One of the core members of the Foreman-Latker group was on the staff of a reform-minded Democratic senator from Indiana, Eli Lilly's home state, named Birch Bayh. To produce a draft of the bill, the group turned to Norman Latker, the HEW general counsel. Latker was the best person for the job, but he had to be very careful. Using federal resources to lobby for legislation was illegal. He had been investigated on similar suspicions in the past, and Califano did not trust him. To be safe, Latker wrote the draft by hand and outsourced the typing to a tech transfer entrepreneur and friend of the group named Mick Stadler. Even without any proof connecting the draft to Latker's office typewriter, Califano got wind of rumors that his general counsel was again working against HEW policy on government time and fired him in December 1978 without separation pay. Latker returned to a lucrative private practice in patent law. With the draft in hand, the group turned to cultivating support for the bill. The most important link between the Foreman-Latker group and the political side of the operation was a 27-year-old Bayh staffer named Joe Allen. When Bayh agreed to sponsor the bill, it was Allen who wrote the speech formally introducing the University and Small Business Patent Procedures Act in the Senate in February 1979. Until the vote, more than a year later, Allen would draft nearly all of Bayh's written and oral remarks on the legislation, from pitches to skeptical labor groups to luncheon talks before friendly audiences like patent lawyers for Bayh and Eli Lilly executives. Allen crafted and stage-managed much of Bayh's advocacy with one of the senator's colleagues foremost in mind. We hoped that limiting our bill to universities and small companies would avoid Senator Long's wrath, Allen said decades later. The ploy showed early signs of success. More than 50 years after the rise of the Research Corporation and WARF Wharf, most people still did not know much about the industry represented by the Society of University Patent Administrators, now called the Association of University Technology Managers, Inc., that lobbied heavily for the bill. Universities' history made them seem more trustworthy than business firms. They would use their patents for public benefit rather than private gain, writes law professor Rebecca Eisenberg. The perceived halos over universities lit the path to passage of the Bayh-Doyle Act. The university patent lobby had come a long way since the debates they sparked in the 1930s. By the 1970s, every major public and private research university had a patent office or hired a contractor to manage its intellectual property as a source of non-traditional revenue. Their association adopted the line set down by Foreman with a focus on loosening restrictions on patenting federally financed research related to public health. In Bayh's speech introducing the bill, Allen inserted the sensational allegation that the development of 29 important medicines had been delayed by government indecision over the dispensation of patent rights. Repeated in the press, the unfounded claim heightened the fear factor around the bill. The Democrats' quaint and anti-business commitment to public science not only threatens American factory jobs, it's killing our grandmothers. Do your elected representatives even care? The strategy was effective. Labor warmed to the idea that patents could drive growth and create jobs, a case made in a March 1979 letter to labor leaders drafted by Allen under Bayh's signature. The most efficient patent policy possible, he wrote, translates into more jobs for the American worker and a higher standard of living not only here, but throughout the world. These arguments resonated with Democratic lawmakers who were announcing their support for the bill in growing numbers. In the spring of 1979, Gaylord Nelson signaled he would support the bill, following the lead of his fellow Wisconsin Democrat Robert Kastenmeier, whose congressional district included the University of Wisconsin and the WARF, a leader of the Bayh-Doyle lobbying coalition. Whether Nelson was also swayed by this powerful home state constituent, his about-face provided cover for other liberal Democrats. The Forman-Latker group was cautiously optimistic as it planned for autumn hearings in Bayh's Judiciary Committee. One Democrat saw through the ruse and refused to go along. Louisiana's Russell Long, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, had spent 3 decades bringing hammers down on industry fingers reaching for patents on government science. From the day Bayh introduced the bill, Long smelled a rat. But as the lobbying campaign gained steam, his allies dwindled. One that never wavered was the only person in town who hated patent incentives and federal R&D more than he did, Admiral Hyman Rickover. These inventions are paid for by the public and therefore should be available for any citizen to use or not as he sees fit, Rickover told a November 1979 hearing on the bill, now co-sponsored by Kansas Republican Bob Dole. The addition of a public interest provision to the bill, reserving march-in rights for the government to ensure the rights holder made products available to the public on reasonable terms, left Rickover unmoved. These rights tend not to be used, he noted, and it would be much simpler to retain the current law. But in making a perfunctory nod to the social obligations of patent holders and reserving ultimate power for the government, the march-in clause provided cover to wavering Democrats looking for reasons to convince themselves the bill was more than a historic giveaway certain to result in more drug monopolies and higher drug prices. A quirk of Senate procedure gave Long all the power he needed. Carter had lost his re-election, and in lame duck sessions, non-budget bills require a unanimous vote to proceed. As federal workers erected the last Carter White House Christmas tree, bedecked with 5-watt energy-saving bulbs, nobody expected Long to do anything but murder Bayh Doyle with his own 2 hands. Then late one afternoon in early December, Bayh, who had also been defeated, was packing boxes in his office when the phone rang. It was Russell Long. After some chit-chat, the elder senator delivered his goodbye gift. "Birch, you can pass your damn patent bill," he said. "I'm really going to miss working with you." After brief floor debates in the Democratic-controlled House and Senate, the bill was sent to the White House. On December 12, 1980, the final day of the 96th Congress, President Carter signed the bill, renamed the Patent and Trademark Law Amendments Act into law. Kennedy's flexible policy of default government title on government-funded research was pulled inside out. The burden now lay with the government to prove its possession of a patent would better serve the public than a private monopoly. Long left no record clarifying the mystery of why the Senate's most dedicated guardian of public science changed his mind. Most accounts of Long's decision ascribe it to senatorial comedy, a magnanimous gesture, according to one contemporary observer, but that seems unlikely. A more probable explanation is that Bob Dole offered Long something big in return, likely related to Louisiana, paired with the assurance, which he also received from Bayh, that the bill was not a Trojan horse for drug companies and would not be expanded to include them. Events soon confirmed Long's initial gut suspicion that the bill was a fake-out. Again, the Commerce Department played the key role. After clearing out his desk in Bayh's office, Joe Allen briefly served as executive director of the Intellectual Property Owners, Inc., a lobby group, before returning to government to help Forman oversee the implementation of Bayh Doyle in the department's Office of Science and Technology Policy. The position also reunited Allen with Norman Latker, back in federal employ as director of the department's patent office. The trio was effectively in charge of overseeing the implementation and expansion of Bayh Doyle, and on their recommendation, Ronald Reagan signed an executive order in 1983 that expanded the law to include corporations of all sizes. The bill was officially amended to fit Reagan's memo in 1984. Having served its temporary purpose, Bayh Doyle's stage prop halo was removed and tossed out the window. The tradition that ended with Bayh Doyle, public science under public control, survived as long as it did because its champions understood that a democratic patent policy has political and economic spillover effects. The general welfare, promised by the Constitution and still unrealized, is not blocked by nature and must not be blocked by the artificial barriers which man erects against man, wrote Walton Hamilton in his TNAC report in 1938. A decade later, the Attorney General's report submitted to Truman argued that only a policy of public ownership will assure free and equal availability of the inventions to American industry and science, will eliminate any competitive advantage to the contractor chosen to perform the research work, will avoid undue concentration of economic power in the hands of a few large corporations, and thus strengthen our American system of free, competitive enterprise. The 1980s showed how fast and how completely generations' worth of public knowledge could be appropriated by invasive parasitic industries, in partnership with public institutions transformed by incentives and temptations introduced by changes in the law. For some observers, the only historical precedent for this process was the Gilded Age parceling of the natural commons. Former FDA Commissioner Donald Kennedy describes Bayh-Doyle as the Homestead Act of the Endless Frontier, an unflattering reference to the 1862 law that divvied up the most prized tracts of the American West among land speculators and railroad barons. Bayh-Doyle opened up government science to business, just as government science budgets exploded as a subset of Reagan's historically high defense budgets. The 1980s upsurge in federal research outlays reflected broader reputational rebounds for science, technology, and even the concept of progress. From the mid-1960s to the late 70s, the early space age optimism of Camelot and Star Trek darkened and gave way to a more nuanced and critical accounting of technology's character and costs. Under the influence of the New Left, the counterculture, and the early environmental movement, the starry vistas of the endless frontier, became crowded in the public mind with cancer-causing pollution, petroleum jelly explosives, and research contracts for next-generation nuclear warheads. This suspicion of what Marxist and counterculture critics called technological rationality was among the targets Republican operatives had in mind when they attacked the malaise of the later Carter years. That the techno-optimism current running through Reagan's Morning in America was represented by Silicon Valley, an offspring of the counterculture, is not without irony. The emergent high-tech industries of the 1980s fed on the same military programs and foreign policies that informed the science skepticism of the 1970s. This shift was embodied in Silicon Valley hype men like Stuart Brand, publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog, who traded in his back-to-the-land philosophy for a spastic digital utopianism. The historic arms buildup of Reagan's first term pushed annual R&D spending past $86 billion in 1983, more than Europe and Japan combined. As the administration pushed federal science spending to new heights, it continued to expand private sector monopoly access to its fruits. The decade of privatized science officially kicked off 2 months before the passage of Bayh-Doyle in October 1980, with Carter's signing of the Stevenson-Wydler Technology Innovation Act. Anticipating Bayh-Doyle, the law required federal labs to create budget lines to help industry find partnerships and file patent applications. When Reagan opened Bayh-Doyle to contractors of all sizes in 1983, the help centers mandated by Stevenson-Wydler in 1980 became insufficient, and in 1986, Reagan signed amendments mandating their expansion. The new centers were part of a wider program to facilitate cooperative research and development agreements, or CRADAs, CRADAs. Crafted in part by Latker and Allen, the CRADAT program turned what had been information booths into luxury suites. Federal laboratories would henceforth feature staff, services, equipment, and facilities to help make the acquisition of title on publicly financed science an easier, more pleasant experience. As of this writing, the NIH website defines the CRADAT program as an exciting opportunity for NIH investigators to join with their colleagues from industry and academia in the joint pursuit of common research goals. Government scientists can leverage their own research resources, as well as serve the larger mission of NIH to facilitate the development and commercialization of healthcare, pharmaceuticals, and products. Companies also can leverage their own R&D efforts while collaborating in state-of-the-art NIH research. These CRADAT red carpets realize the kind of futuristic nightmare Morris Fishbein might have had during the controversy over Steinbach's vitamin D patent. From a commitment to the open pursuit of knowledge, a free, flowing exchange of ideas, and unrestricted publication, public universities had adopted the perspectives and interests of industry, including those conflicting with once sacred norms around publishing and secrecy. It is important to recall how new these norms were even within the research divisions of the largest pharmaceutical companies. In 1949, Merck's executives triggered an internal company revolt by pushing a policy of delaying publication of research related to new drugs for 5 years after the patent filing. The company's outraged senior scientists quashed the idea as incomprehensible, detrimental to the company, and totally unacceptable. In the words of one Merck researcher quoted by Dominique Taubel, "The same pressures that transformed industry publishing norms in the 1950s were now pressed on academic laboratories to the same result." As early as 1983, a report published by the 20th Century Fund titled Midas in the Academy would note the suddenness of this change and lament, "The stage has perhaps been reached at which almost every biological advance discovered in American universities is made by, or made known before publication to, someone who has a possible commercial interest in keeping it secret." The post-by Doyle University lab was the subject of a deeper investigation published the following year. David Dixon's 1984, The New Politics of Science. A veteran Washington correspondent for Science and Nature, Dixon painted the era's defining portrait of Bai Doyle's impact on the culture of academic research. In pushing for the new legislation, universities argued strongly that patents could generate a source of much-needed income, he wrote. This income, however, was premised on parceling up the results of research programs into a form over which private companies could exert direct and usually exclusive control, an essential step in securing scientific knowledge for the private marketplace. Few of the old ethical holdouts from the first wave of university patenting remained on the sidelines as opportunities for profiting off industry involvement grew over the decade. In 1934, Harvard adopted a policy of dedicating all patents related to therapeutics or public health to the public domain. 50 years later, it specialized in partnerships that allowed corporations to set the terms. Harvard President Derek Buck directed the university's embrace of what he called a new breed of speculative deal, while at the same time conceding the dangers to academic science seem real and severe. Dixon marveled at how quickly Bai Doyle had eroded the deepest of academic research conventions. By the end of Reagan's first term, university officials no longer denied or apologized for suspending or revising centuries-old open publication norms under pressure from corporate partners. Drug companies were likewise done apologizing. They saw their new power as an entitlement. In a 1982 address to the nation's medical school deans, a senior Johnson & Johnson executive informed his audience that patents are a must. Prigs who criticized delaying publication to protect corporate advantage, he said, must abandon this narrow view. The wider view on publishing delays was dutifully adopted by universities under the advice of their tech transfer officers. When Dixon started researching his book in 1981, the long-standing scientific norm of publishing without delay had been adjusted to within 2 months, or enough time to file and win a patent claim. When he submitted his manuscript in 1984, the norm had been loosened to 4 months or more. A subsequent study conducted by Massachusetts General Hospital found that nearly 60% of leading life science firms contractually required academic partners to delay publishing any data for at least 6 months. The cause of this sea change was not a mystery. The Bai-Doyle policy of default private claims on public science created new incentives and dynamics wherever that science was produced. Universities and newly ensconced empowered companies and speculators conspired to rewrite the rules around scientific production to maximize their respective shares of the gains. That a melding of values followed is not surprising. When asked in 1982 about the impact of Bai Doyle, University of California immunologist Leon Woofsey shrugged, telling a reporter, "The motive force of the universities is the pursuit of knowledge. The business of business is to make money."